This is A Word, a podcast from Slate. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. Spring break means freedom, fun, and sometimes foolishness for college students. And for young African Americans in the 1990s, it also meant Freaknik. The annual party drew tens of thousands to Atlanta every year. So why did the fun stop, and could it ever start again?
And I think the biggest misconception was that it was just a party, when in fact it was about Black joy, Black celebration, Black sexuality, politics. So hopefully when you watch the film, you see all of those layers beyond just the party.
More on the documentary Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told, coming up on A Word with me, Jason Johnson. Stay with us. Welcome to A Word, a podcast about race and politics and everything else. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. Nostalgia for the 1990s is everywhere, with aging Gen Xers trying to relive their youth and young Zillennials discovering the TV, films, and fashion of that decade for the first time. For Black folks, perhaps nothing symbolizes the fun of the 1990s more than Freaknik, a sprawling, days-long festival of all the good and bad of spring break behavior. And at its height, Freaknik drew tens of thousands of partiers to Atlanta each year from around the country. It started as an annual picnic for students of Atlanta University Center, or the AUC. That's the group of historically Black colleges and universities around the city. But it quickly grew into a national event after Spike Lee's School Days and the sitcom A Different World reignited interest in HBCU life in general, and Freaknik in particular.
How are we gonna hit the road for DC?
6 o'clock.
So your parents don't mind?
Well, Mom was cool until I mentioned the word Freaknik.
Now that was your first mistake. You should have told her it was just an outdoor concert.
I did. That made it worse. She was at Woodstock.
Well, it wasn't exactly Woodstock. Freaknik did share the freewheeling, sex positive, and less than sober spirit. But instead of a one-time thing, Freaknik was an annual event for years. But after a decade, the Freaknik wore out its welcome in Atlanta, and the city started shutting the party down. So what was the magic of Freaknik? What happened to it? And can anything capture that kind of energy again? Those questions are examined in the documentary series Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told, which is currently streaming on Hulu. Joining us now to talk about it is Geraldine Porras, an executive producer of the documentary, and P. Frank Williams, the director. Geraldine Porras and P. Frank Williams, welcome to A Word.
Thank you so much, Jason.
Appreciate it.
Geraldine, what attracted you to this project? What made you say, when people came to you, I assume it was 2 or 3 years ago, let's put this together?
Yeah, I think Freaknik is something that, regardless of your age, where you live, your background, it's something that you've at least heard of. You might not know too much about it if you didn't attend, but Freaknik is something that very much lives in the ether, in the atmosphere. And so I am someone who was unfortunately too young to attend. So when I heard Freaknik, it felt like my opportunity to finally be a part of it in some capacity and be able to really tell the history and the legacy of this infamous street party.
Thanks again for having us. You know, I think there's a fascination with Freaknik amongst the millennials and Gen Z about this nostalgia that you see Drake and Lotto and all these people wanting to relive the 90s, and sort of the fascination with the fun and abandonment. It was before a phone and a DM. I think that was the biggest thing why I think this generation wanted to reconnect with that.
This documentary opens up with a celebration of something called Freaknik 2022. And it's a bunch of young people talking about what they know, what they think they knew about Freaknik. Here's a clip.
Hey man, Freaknik's always a vibe.
And most of us, we were born in the 90s.
The 90s aesthetics,
and so I wanted to give a little sparkle, a little shine, a little body, you know?
Just the culture of Atlanta, and Freaknik is very important to that, you know, hip-hop, all of that shit.
Real Atlanta shit, real Freaknik shit, yeah.
We coming from the 90s, so we only bring home gold trophies, that's it.
P. Frank, what is the biggest misconception that Zoomers, or maybe even young millennials, have about Freaknik?
I think when you look at the young people who were at 21 Savage's birthday party, which is what we shot and started the film out with, this film is a multi-generational conversation, right? People 21's age, early 30s, whether my kids who are 19, are fascinated with Freaknik because it's our summer of soul, our Woodstock. And so I think that's why we opened the film, just to show that a new generation is fascinated. And I think the biggest misconception was that it was just a party, that it was just a bunch of people turning up in the streets, when in fact, it was about Black joy, Black celebration, Black sexuality, politics, a lot of things, race. And so hopefully when you watch the film, you see all of those layers beyond just the party.
So Geraldine mentioned earlier that she didn't get a chance to go to Freaknik. I have to ask you, P. Frank, what was your most memorable Freaknik moment?
I was fortunate enough to, as a young college man coming of age in the early 90s and being in a fraternity, I'm in Alpha Phi Alpha. I think that was a big part of the Freaknik thing, the Divine Nine. And so coming from a predominantly white college, seeing that sea of black faces who were having a good time, who were reveling, I never seen that amount of beautiful black women in one place. So that was amazing. And so it was just really like a really unbelievable. This was in the early 90s. And this was before Freaknik got totally out of control. It was more in the 50, 60, 75,000 than the hundreds of thousands.
Geraldine, you talked with some of the folks who started the party that became Freaknik. We're going to play a clip. I want to get your thoughts on the other side.
The title is absolutely misleading because you would think it was just something where everybody's wilding and people stripping on the streets and, you know, having sex everywhere. But Freaknik was just a party. It was just a Southern cookout, right?
We needed to promote it, advertise it. We had to buy food, and we would sell the food, hot dogs and potato chips and, you know, that kind of stuff, sodas and beer.
We selected the spot for the first one. This was nondescript area of Piedmont Park on the corner of 10th Avenue and Monroe Drive that at that time was really pretty barren and just a good spot we could meet there.
Who were these folks, and like, what was their vision? What was their plan in the early 80s when they were just putting Freaknik together?
What a lot of people don't know is that Freaknik was actually started by the DC Metro Club, which is a group of social clubs that were part of the campus, the AUC, for folks from different areas to get together and form community. It's kind of like social media before social media was a thing. So these kids, spring break came around and it was time for folks to go home, and they couldn't afford. There was a group of students who couldn't afford to go back home to DC. And so they decided that they were going to throw a spring picnic so that the other students that couldn't afford to go home had a place to hang out and just have fun together during spring break. And so that's really where the idea started. They had several different events around this theme, the Freak, that year. And so a lot of people didn't know that that's really where Freaknik started. It was a picnic, and then they had their theme, the Freak. And as you see in the film, they put those things together and created Freaknik. And it was really just a space and an opportunity for them to join together in fellowship and have fun, since a lot of the other spring break places, if they weren't going home, were for majority white college students. And so there wasn't really too many spaces for them to really have that community in that space. So they created it themselves.
We're going to take a short break, and we come back more on the history of Freaknik. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking with the creators of Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told, on Hulu. Our guests are director P. Frank Williams and executive producer Geraldine Portas. This is one thing, and this is a question for you, P. Frank. My understanding and one of my sort of direct experiences with Freaknik was VHS tapes. And you'd be in a barbershop in DC, and like somebody would be like, yo, I got tapes from Freaknik, and they will put it in the VCR in the barbershop. And that's how we got to see it. That's what we did before social media. That was my first time really being able to see what was going on down there. My question for you is, as a director, as a producer, how did you all get the video? A lot of this stuff isn't digitized. It's film from 25, 30 years ago. It's in boxes of VHS tapes that are in the back of somebody's garage. How long did it take, and how did you go about collecting the footage to put this documentary together?
Well, when I think you said it, you hit the nail on the head, is that, you know, there's a bunch of tapes, Hi8, VHS, DV tapes, camcorder tapes that were out in somebody's basement or garage. You know, Auntie Cheryl didn't really want you to know that she had those tapes. So Uncle Jimmy, when him and his boys in 94 jumped in a Camry and rolled all the way, you know, to Atlanta. So no, after Jermaine Dupri And then Luke put out the bat signal, as well as myself and a couple other producers involved. People started sending in stuff, and we were able to kind of comb through that stuff, find the best and the brightest and stuff that hadn't been on the internet, which really helped. I think we really wanted to make sure we put exclusive footage that most people hadn't seen, and obviously careful not to, you know, be too explicit or too raw. I know everybody thought this was going to be the Ratchet Party, which it did not turn out to be. But no, we were able to get a lot of tapes and archival footage from people all over the country and the world.
Jordan, there was a time in the early 90s where we were sort of having this discussion of how women felt free and more comfortable in their sexuality. And you had musicians, Idina Howard saying, like, I'm gonna be a freak, and people were comfortable with it. And you had Salt and Pepper saying, let's talk about sex. And so many young Black women who up until that point had not had those opportunities, had not had those safe spaces, really felt free to be sexually liberated. I want to play you this clip and get your thoughts on the other side.
You know how some people have some inhibition, you know, that they just want to do something that they just know they can't do at home because they know people in their neighborhood, they know people at their schools, and their parents will somehow find out. I mean, you come out to another place and then it's like a whole bunch of people from other places who don't know you, and you kind of feel like, okay, well, maybe I can get away with this here, you know. Well, some people are actually like that at home, which I'm not going to talk about.
How representative is it of women at Freaknik that they really did feel comfortable in their sexuality? They didn't feel in fear dancing on cars, flashing their chests and everything else like that. Was it really sort of an open air hedonism, at least for some women for a while? Was that your experience when you talked to, interviewed and reviewed tape?
I think it really depended on the woman, right? You know, some people came in there, they knew it was Freaknik, and they knew that was their opportunity to let loose. And then there was other people that were a bit more conservative. So I think it depended a lot on the woman, their personality, and what they were comfortable with. But the point was that Freaknik was this space that really felt safe. You know, it was an event that started off for college students. And so you are around and amongst all of your peers. So in a place like Atlanta and Georgia and the South, where it's traditionally very conservative, like P. Frank mentioned, a part of the Bible Belt, women didn't always feel the opportunities to be able to express themselves either through the way that they dress, how they were dancing, or, you know, really just have that autonomy over their bodies.
A lot of the perception about Freaknik in this documentary beforehand is everybody thought it was going to be BET uncut, right? Like, people were terrified. And I think a lot of people were surprised to see how much really focused on the music industry, how much really focused on the politics. Talk a little bit about the importance of music. What role did major artists like Jermaine Dupri and Uncle Luke, what role did they play in turning Freaknik from just a college party into basically a national event?
People keep talking about, you know, what is the documentary? It's a music documentary, because without the music, it doesn't feed the culture, the pace, the sound. The soundtrack of Freaknik is really the rise of Atlanta as a music capital, meaning Jermaine Dupri, So Def, Dallas Austin, Rowdy Records, LaFace, Babyface. If you look at the parallel rise of Atlanta, especially the capital of Black music, it parallels Freaknik. So you can't have Freaknik without the music.
And, you know, one other part that I noticed, and I loved how you all presented this in the documentary, is it also allowed these artists to almost bypass some of the restrictions of the label system and the record system at the time, right? You didn't have to fight for radio play if you could get your sample tape out there. You know, by the early 1990s, documentary sort of talks about the fact that the highly sexualized reputation of Freaknik became more obvious. And in some ways, it's like Luke Campbell kind of says, hey, Two Live Crew, we were responsible for that. He even talks about in this clip that I want to play right now.
I think I had a large influence on more people coming, because it became word of mouth. You know, word of mouth is, man, they got this wild, crazy, freaky party. Then now on top of it, you got me do a fucking Work It Out video. And the Work It Out video is shot at Freaknik. And then now that song became big, and before you know it, people would then come back to Freaknik because you heard the stories. Man, that shit was crazy. Man, the girls was this and that. Man, the dudes was this. Man, we never slept a day while we was at Freaknik. We just all got a hotel room. We never even stayed in there. We was fucking having sex on the streets. I mean, you name it. It was guys doing it. I just brought the freak to Freaknik.
I don't mean to be critical. I know this sort of works with Campbell's reputation at this point, but was he really did he bring Sexy back? Did he bring Sexy into Atlanta? Because it seems to me Atlanta always had a stripper culture. You already had a bunch of young people having a good time. You know, P. Frank, how much was Luke Campbell himself responsible for bringing that sort of raunchy reputation to Freaknik?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously Atlanta has a stripper culture. It already had sort of an underground club nightlife, but you are still in the Bible Belt of America. I think people don't realize that, you know, it was, even though Freaknik was this sort of fun, crazy festival, you had a lot of black middle-class people, conservative, who really weren't with all of these black people in the street having fun and acting a fool. But I do think that when Luke films the Work It Out video in 93, it's a turning point where his music and the energy of his music makes you want to party. I can't say that Luke is the main reason because it was obviously there, but I do think that the energy and the sound of his music changed the direction of Freaknik in a way where people want to get a little bit more buck wild and loose. Who's to say that they weren't having sex in the streets or doing wild stuff before that? But I do think because Two Live Crew, because of Luke's reputation, and he literally films a video at Freaknik, that message gets out to the masses and people in turn think, oh, wow, I'm going to go party and ball out and act wild just like Luke did. So I think that you can't, you know, as Luke told you in the film, he put the freak in Freaknik.
We're going to take a short break and we come back more about Freaknik, the wildest party never told. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned. You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about the documentary Freaknik, The Wildest Party Never Told. Our guest is executive producer Geraldine Porlas and director P. Frank Williams. So, Geraldine, Atlanta won the opportunity to host the 1996 Summer Olympics. And as somebody who used to live in Atlanta, as somebody who has friends down there, you know, everybody talks about the fact that there's the pre-Olympics Atlanta and the post-Olympics Atlanta. Like, it completely changed the city around. How did getting the Summer Olympics of 96 change Freaknik?
The 1996 Olympics coming to Atlanta put the spotlight on Atlanta, not just in the country, but around the world. And so now the stakes are a bit higher for Atlanta. You know, the pressure really comes on to maintain a certain image. And so Freaknik didn't always align with that image. I think we talk about the fact that, you know, P. Frank mentioned Atlanta and Georgia is part of the Bible Belt. There's respectability politics that come into play. And so Freaknik was this weekend where everyone really let loose and it was hard for the city to manage. And that wasn't necessarily a good look for Atlanta when the world is looking at you to host the Olympics, such a monumental event. And so I think that that energy naturally, that served as a point where the city wanted to start breaking down that energy of Freaknik in order to, you know, relieve some of that, some of the folks from coming, discourage people from coming from different places to participate in Freaknik because it wasn't necessarily conducive or aligned with the type of appearance that Atlanta wanted to have for the Olympics.
P. Frank, there was a moment when the tide started to turn in Atlanta and officials didn't want Freaknik around anymore. What I thought was interesting, some of this seemed to be economic backlash, right? Some businesses were saying, hey, we're not making enough money, and they're calling on politicians to do something about it. And some of it seemed to be sort of morality policing and, you know, perception of how black people are presented. Which one do you think was a greater catalyst for eventually shutting Freaknik down? Was it the sort of moral outcry of black leadership or the economic outcry of various business people who say, this just ain't working for me anymore?
It's a combo platter. I mean, number one is money in any country, any place all over the world. If people aren't making their money and you're the mayor of that city, you got to make sure that the economics of the city, the business, white, black, green, or whatever, is okay. So I think that's the first thing that a lot of people couldn't get to their businesses. Pregnant women couldn't get to the hospital. It was really the traffic, too, by the way. which is an economic part. It's just still traffic is a part of it. But I also think that, you know, there was a black conservative sort of mentality. It's like these kids have gotten out of control. They're a black eye to black America. And so I do think that there was a morality part of it. But I also think the sexual assaults and stuff like that. You know, there was a point in the film where we had sort of a camera of the grid of the city, and you could see all over the city different assaults. We didn't put that in the film ultimately, but I think that me watching that and seeing some of the things that were going on made me realize that it was the economic troubles and some moralities, but also the assaults. You just couldn't do that. You can't have that kind of public safety issue. So it was a combination to me.
There's this feeling that you couldn't have Freak Nick now. And you couldn't have Freak Nick now because of things like social media, because of things like sort of over-policing of cities and everything else like that. My question to you, Geraldine, is do you think that's true? Do you think that we now live in a culture where because everything is captured on phones, because people spend more time, you know, trying to make selfies than they do dancing on the roofs of cars, that we've lost something of that spirit and we couldn't have a Freak Nick again?
I think that's accurate. You know, we've lost some of the, you know, the connection to other folks. Social media sometimes gives us this false idea that we're more connected to people. But when you see groups of kids out now, like everyone has their face in their phone. They might be texting each other, sitting right next to each other before they're actually having a conversation. And so I think that that naturally dilutes some of the energy that was very prevalent at Freak Nick, right? And so because there's all these layers to Freak Nick, technology has advanced so much that I think we are just more aware that we're always being watched in some capacity, whether it's by people on their phones or security cameras and things like that. And so I think it naturally inhibits us from feeling so free and so able to do, you know, to celebrate in a way that we could back in the 90s. Things have changed a lot, and I don't know that you can still capture that same energy that we had back at Freak Nick.
Geraldine Porras is an executive producer, and Pete Frank Williams is the director of Freak Nick, The Wildest Party Never Told. It's available on Hulu. Thank you both so much for joining us today on A Word.
Thank you.
Appreciate you, Jason. Peace.
That's A Word for this week. The show's email is aword@slate.com. This episode was produced by Ayana Angel. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the Vice President of Slate Audio. Our theme music was produced by Don Will. I'm Jason Johnson. Tune in next week for A Word.